and gentlemen, fellow slaves of the plantation, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show. It's Vinny with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinny Eastwood Show. The only thing worse than the truth is Vinny's jokes.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode, appearing just on time, as always, with no technical difficulties yet to be eclipsing the wonderful magnanimousness that is the Vinny Eastwood Show. Now, my very special guest joining me today for 2 hours of expediently spankable radio is Joe Atwill. The writer of Caesar's Messiah, and since I last talked to him, that wasn't his only book. He's now got more. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, Vinny, it's great to be back and good to see you.
It's borderlining on fabulous, I must agree. Now, we have gone through and mapped out an enormous amount of interesting information, a lot of which I'm not actually familiar with. I believe... that I've got the wrong thing here, but in either case, Joe, before we start getting into the information, would you just please explain a little bit about yourself and what it is you do?
Well, I'm an author at this point, and come from the software industry, grew up in Japan, and went to St. Mary's Military Academy, where I was trained by Jesuits, and so I developed a fascination with the character Jesus Christ. I had some time, did a lot of research as I was able to focus on it, having sold my business, and basically developed my own take on the Gospels, which I then wrote Caesar's Messiah to bring the theory to the public. The book was very successful, and following that, I was very interested in a play that Shakespeare had written, because the character's name was Titus Andronicus. And if you've read Caesar's Messiah, you'll remember that I had focused the creation of the Gospels basically on the Flavian family, specifically Titus Flavius. So the Shakespearean play had as a title Titus Andronicus, and I was curious about this because Andronici was, he's mentioned in 2 Maccabees as someone who sacked the Temple of Jerusalem. So there's only a handful of people that have ever done this. One is Titus Flavius, and another is Andronici. And so I was curious to know if Shakespeare had actually written a play that had some relationship to Titus Flavius because of the name Titus Andronicus. And so when I was reading the play, I came to a passage and my brain froze because the passage went something to the effect that someone's talking to Titus Andronicus and he says, "Where's your brother?" And Titus Andronicus says, "Well, he's alone killing flies." And then the other guy goes, "Why is he doing that?" And Titus Andronicus, you know, says, "Well, it's just what he likes to do." And then the guy says, "Well, it doesn't become Titus's brother to kill flies." Now, clearly this is a comment on the Flavian family, because Titus's brother Domitian was the most famous killer of flies in ancient literature. And so I studied the play then more carefully, and I could see that whoever wrote the thing knew everything that I knew about the Gospels, that all of the understanding that I have in Caesar's Messiah about the typology and the way that you can understand, you know, who Jesus is actually talking about, if you kind of decode it using the right interpretive framework. That whoever had written the Shakespearean literature had exactly the same perspective, but with an important difference, and that is that he totally reversed it. Whereas the Gospels are a Roman reworking of Hebraic scripture in order to create a kind of Jewish cartoon, basically, from the Roman perspective. Shakespeare is exactly the opposite. It's written by a Jewish woman named Amelia Bassano, and she basically turns the tables on the Gentile royal family, and so that all of her plays are basically cryptic pie in the face to the Gentile nobility. And so I developed this theory. I showed it to a guy named John Hudson, who's a Shakespearean scholar. He concurred, and he wrote a book called The Dark Lady, which, you know, talks about Amelia Bassano as the author of the plays. And the theory is getting, you know, good hearing. It's been accepted as one of the seven coherent interpretations of Shakespeare by the Shakespearean Academy. You know, so it's starting to have some momentum. Now, having written the that bit, I was asked by a group if I had an opinion about Neo-Christianity, which is basically kind of the channeling business where people are they're talking to Jesus, they're talking to the saints, and they have this kind of peculiar version of Christianity where they just accept everything, forgive everything. It's this very, very placid theology. And so
sounds like a group of people that'd be quite easy to fucking conquer, isn't it?
Oh, it wouldn't be too difficult because, see, I had written, the reason why they were asking me to do this is because I'd written a paper about Constantine making Christianity the state religion. And I said, look, it's perfectly obvious that Constantine had two series of edicts. One of them sets up Christianity, but the other one creates the feudal system, right? Now, the two are simply one system. You now have, instead of Caesar running everything, you have the Pontiff Maximus, right? But that's the official title of the Pope, but that's just one of the titles that Caesar had. It means the head of the Roman College of Priests. The Vatican is located on the Palatine, which is where the Caesars had their royal palace. So you know that they didn't even move. They just changed name. And now that the serf wouldn't rebel because instead of Caesar, he was basically dealing with the representative of Jesus Christ on the planet. So it was just a Christianity as Constantine used it as the state religion was just a psyops. It was just
a thing.
Sure.
So basically the emperor goes like this, you know, I'm a man, I can be killed, I can be overthrown, and I've got servants and stuff like that. And the only thing that people have in faith more than me as their ruler and their keeper is God. So what if I just told them that I was blessed by God and that to rebel against me is to rebel against God itself, which is the only thing that you fear more than anything, hence the fear of God in you.
Yeah.
And then just freaking...
You would have made a terrible Christian.
I was, man. My mum, she had to bribe us with ice creams to go there. And most of the time, I was just feeling very, very slow. Maybe I was just allergic to mind control at a very young age. I don't know.
Well, you absolutely described it. That's exactly what happened. And it worked for 1,500 years. The Pontiff Maximus was basically Caesar with Jesus Christ in front of him. And so this worked really well. The neo-Christianity was therefore under some scrutiny by scholars. People were wondering about this channeling business. And so some people who had read my paper about Constantine and liked it asked me if I had an opinion about A Course in Miracles, which was an insane book. It was written by these two psychologists, Thetford and Schuckman. And as I started to research them, I realized that they were employees of this organization called MKUltra. All right, so they were payrolled employees of the CIA in this project, which was basically trying to study how to control the masses and individuals. And I thought this was very suspicious. You know, I said, wait a second. Because Schuckman, who the individual who is channeling Jesus Christ, is a cognitive psychologist who is a specialist in crowd control. She's Jewish. And it just seemed unlikely that this would be the person Jesus Christ would pick to channel this new version of Christianity, which basically says, just obey and don't complain about anything.
Because obviously that's what Jesus was all about, you know.
Yeah, that's what he's all about. Yeah. So I at that time when I was doing the study, there was other researchers doing, you know, kind of other areas of MK Ultra or of sort of the government mucking around in the culture. Dave McGowan was doing research into Laurel Canyon. Jan Irvin was doing research into this guy named Gordon Wasson.
You'll have to define Laurel Canyon for me, I'm afraid. I'm a bit
Laurel Canyon is where the Los Angeles-based rock and roll scene that sprang up in the late 60s came from. All of these individuals, Frank Zappa, The Doors, The Byrds, The Mamas and the Papas, The Association, they all lived in this one canyon, Laurel Canyon. And Dave McGowan did research and was shocked that they were all the sons and daughters of military intelligence. Jim Morrison, his father, was the admiral who was in charge of the Gulf of Tonkin, the false flag that created the Vietnam War. Frank Zappa's father was worked for the CIA developing chemical drugs. I mean, so McGowan wrote a book called Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon that outlines this. But he was just shocked that and he was very certain that it was an operation of some kind. He said he just couldn't have every single one of these guys come from military intelligence and not have some kind of connection into military intelligence. He didn't really understand what was the purpose for this. He guessed it might be basically to discredit the peace movement, which isn't a theory that holds water, but that was a good guess on his part. At the same time, there was information coming out from the Freedom of Information Act about this Project MKUltra. And one of the documents, which was found by Dr. Colin Ross, who was a Canadian psychiatrist who was doing research into the damage that patients that he was treating had experienced from MKUltra experiments, basically as children. Right. So he was doing that research, and he found that the trip which began the psychedelic movement, it was actually on the cover of Life magazine in 1957, May 1957. And that magazine had this huge story about this guy named Gordon Wasson, who supposedly went into the Mexican desert, met a shaman priestess, and she gave him psychedelic mushrooms. He experienced a religious event, and he came back and wrote about it in Life magazine. Well, in fact, Gordon Wasson, like Thetford and Schuckman, was an employee of MKUltra, because what Ross found was the pay requisition for Wasson's trips to Mexico to create this cover narrative, this story. Because it turned out the story that he told was completely fake. In other words, the natives did know about the mushroom. They knew it was, psychoactive, but they weren't using it as part of a religious tradition. At the same time, Dr. Jay Fikes, an anthropologist, was doing research into the Huichol Indians. And they were there, the peyote Indians. This is where Carlos Castaneda was supposedly, finding this spiritual culture. Well, Jay, he actually did everything that Castaneda claimed. In other words, he lived with the Huichol for years. He was part of the, did peyote ceremonies and everything. And he determined that Castaneda didn't exist. And in fact, he was working with the CIA. He wrote a book about it. There was various lawsuits trying to prevent him from publishing it. Jay is now a public person, and people can just correspond with him and buy his books and see what his research brings to you. The third thing that was going on at this time was William Burroughs tripped into the Amazon, and he was, you know, claiming to be looking for ayahuasca. There's a video where he says he's found the last shaman and he's had this, you know, this psychedelic experience. But again, research shows that there was no ayahuasca spiritual culture. It just didn't exist. The Indians actually thought of the drug more as a nuisance and as something that, you know, produced basically lives that were, you know, like Grateful Deadheads, you know, that people would just, they wouldn't be useful or valuable. They would just take the drugs. And they actually wrote about that. And the codexes, the Florentine Codex and letters from the missionary confirm this. So what had happened was, is the counterculture was being created by, you know, what I would call the secret society. It had a focus through MKUltra. That was its primary funding source. And that was where a lot of the psychological science comes from.
So yeah. You've got like a whole generation of very sober, studious, intelligent, and active people, and you need to either control them or derail them and do it by any means necessary.
Yeah, yeah. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll was the idea.
Now, and so, at what point does sex, drugs, and rock and roll get shit done?
It never works out, unfortunately.
Like, what do you do during your 20s and your 30s and your earlier life? You're working really hard. You're building up your amount of money and your contributions into the economy. You're creating your businesses for the first time, try and fail, and so on and so forth. But if you can rob somebody of maybe 10 to 15 years of that progress, you can essentially turn them into a very powerless member of society that has none of their own resources.
Absolutely. And so what was happening was a very large scale destruction of the culture, and it began even before the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That was kind of on the way to the conclusion. But the first thing they did was they shattered the ethnic communities. I mean, if you think about political strength, ethnic communities had it, right? They could defend themselves. There was extended families. There was a focus on the ethnicity. There was basically the ability to financially assist one another. They were powerful entities. And so that was destroyed. They shattered these communities by basically what can be called weaponized integration, where they would put particularly impoverished black sharecroppers into, say, example, like an Irish neighborhood in Detroit. And then the Irish would leave. But when they left, they basically lost their ethnic communities. They became what was really the deracinated white middle class of America that lived in the suburbs. This was then the generation that was vulnerable to the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. A friend of mine, I was talking to him the other day, and he grew up in an Irish community in Lake Erie, Pennsylvania. And he said that one day a guy came into town and he was selling pornography, you know, dirty pictures. This was in the 50s. He said the dads found out about it and just beat the hell out of him, right? And that was the ethnic community responding and driving out the pollution. Well, when you have the deracinated middle class, you don't really have that function any longer. And so what now took place was, you know, the Great Society programs, the rise of Planned Parenthood, abortion, and marriages stopped happening in America.
It turns out Bill Gates of Microsoft fame, his dad was on Planned Parenthood.
Yeah. Well, that was how Gates became the owner of Microsoft. I mean, Gates is an obvious artificial person. I call someone like that a lifetime actor. I was in the software business at this time, and every single person out there knew that the IBM personal computer was going to be one of the most valuable financial products in history. It was absolutely clear. No one had any doubts. And when they gave the operating system to Bill Gates, everyone knew that there was something wrong. They knew that they thought there might be some kind of payoff or payola. I've known, you know, with IBM's financial might, this seemed bizarre. No one really understood it, but they knew it was wrong because Gates could not code. He didn't even own an operating system. DOS, he had to buy it from someone who was just an amateur software designer with no particular skills. The idea that IBM would make this transaction with Gates was just preposterous. Gates was an artificial creation. What it was, Vinny, is they knew they were going to use the personal computer and the iPhone for observation. It was going to be the government device to know where every single person was at all time. You're going to see they're going to try to get rid of cash so that all of your financial transactions will be done on your electronic device. So the iPhone is, you know, obviously quite a long way toward this electronic slavery that they're going to create. But back then when they were starting it, they wanted to create characters that the young people would relate to. IBM at that time was seen as akin to Big Brother. And so when Gates and then Steve Jobs came along, they actually had advertisements about how this is rebellion. This is, you know, doing your own thing. You know, your Jobs famously claims that he took LSD. And so you now have a marketing campaign for the target group. You know, they're going to basically create the, as they develop the technology, they would have this capacity to monitor everyone. And they wanted to have hip young people be in charge of the product. So Gates is a completely artificial character. And the fact that his father was the head of Planned Parenthood. Remember, Planned Parenthood is just the Eugenic Society. It changed its name, but it's a Huxley creation. So the fact that Gates' father is in charge of it.
That reminds me, Gates is a big pusher of vaccines. And it turns out that the vaccines have double the worst, the bad side effects on black children than they do on white children and other races. Yeah. And so there you go. There's the eugenics agenda again.
Sure. It is as clear as a bell, frankly. I think that you can really see the electronic slavery and the eugenics and the genocide. The program that the Eugenic Society and the Huxleys had been basically advocating for over 100 years. You could just see that when they were finally going to, you know, to bring it into motion, they had to make some changes in order to basically have the public not be aware that this was going on.
Because they'd be too distracted. They'd be too distracted from the hip music and being off
exactly,
their faces.
Exactly. I mean,
they wouldn't even notice that they were becoming slaves their entire life. And then when they wake up, like 20, 30, 40 years later, or something like that, to the fact that they are slaves, and somebody tells them about it, they don't believe it, and then get really angry at the person because that person is basically saying to them, "Look, your entire life has been a sham, bro. You've been living you've been living a dream."
You've been living a dream. You've been very clever people who studied how the mind operates have created what you see as history and culture. One really good place to for people to start to understand what happened to them is the band The Grateful Dead. The handler for the band, Hank Harrison, he is Courtney Love's father. And he was asked why all of the handbills and the advertising for the Warlocks, the band this was the Grateful Dead, that was just their first name, was the Warlocks. Why is it all Masonic? And she actually showed all of the original handbills, all the posters, and every one of them has the all-seeing eye, the temples of Joaquin and Boaz, and just has all of the Freemason regalia. And Harrison goes, oh, that's easy. I can tell you, because we're Masons. And our families are Masons. See, Masonic families, right? This is the key, is that, is so like John Lennon, right? When you look at Lennon, his father brings out an album, look at the floor that he's standing on. It's the black and white checkerboard, right? So you have these Masonic families that basically are used to select the individuals that they're going to put into position for the different cultural destructive forces. But so the Grateful Dead, if you look at the band members and Ozzy, the character who was making the LSD, you have one outed employee of the CIA, Robert Hunter. He was working, he actually was a MK Ultra employee. You have three members of the Bohemian Grove. And you have, and then three Freemasons, right? So the way that, and then of course you have the banking family, Billy Hitchcock, who's funding it, Melissa Cargill, the Cargill family, and the Mellon family, the banking family. And the Mellons were important because they were basically running the OSS, which becomes the CIA in Europe. Mm. Right. So when you see Billy Hitchcock.
And when the OSS was created, its primary role was disinformation and actually confusing communications with the Nazis. One time they actually stole a mail train that was bound for Germany and filled it full of fake letters addressed to the same people and stuff like that, full of weird information, and then just popped it back on the tracks and sent it in. Right.
Yeah.
And so nobody knew what the hell was going on. And they figured that that's actually the most useful asset in war, is simply to confuse your enemy so that they don't know if their own people can be trusted. They're too busy fighting amongst themselves to even resist you. And that's precisely what they're doing to the population at large, isn't it?
Exactly. It's a perfect analogy. And so the Grateful Dead, the collection of individuals, of the CIA employees, the Freemasons. And then just to show you the international flavor, in 1960, Jerry Garcia, who was the lead singer of the Grateful Dead, and Robert Hunter, who was working with the CIA, they were in a car crash outside of the MKUltra hospital. Remember, the Grateful Dead are in Menlo Park area, which is where where MK Ultra basically is headquartered at this time, in the Palo Alto VA, and this is where Gregory Bateson and all the original sort of cast of the MK Ultra doctors are there doing research, which is why the Grateful Dead comes out of this very location. But anyway, they are all living there, and they get in a car accident, and the police recorded the individuals who were in the car, and one of them was Alan Trist. Now, he's a British individual. His father is Eric Trist. He's the founder of the Tavistock Institute, right? So the Tavistock Institute in Britain, which is studying, mind control, which is basically the British Secret Service intellectual component to be able to develop social control, has an individual on the ground before they're even called the Grateful Dead. I mean, he's with them when they're still the Warlocks, which is, before that. Then you have...
And this is at a time when they're in a car crash where they're grateful to be alive still.
Yeah. Vinny, where do you come up with this stuff? I mean, maybe that's where they got the reverse of the title.
That's why they gave me the
show. Yeah, so that's right. So they weren't the Grateful Dead then. They could have been if they, if they had a worse car crash. But anyway, so... You've got all of these components that are basically being structured to, promote drug use. I mean, they want the population to take their new super drug LSD. They want the ideas of basically what's called an archaic revival. You have to go back. You're not old enough, but I am. And I was there when the counterculture first came out in the late 60s, and it was all about returning to nature, right? You'd take LSD, you'd listen to the music, you'd have sex with different people, and then you would be in these communes or in, different ways of kind of alternative lifestyle. You hated the man, you hated anything to do with structure and authority, and All of the songs are promoting this. And they wanted you basically to do what could be called an archaic revival, to revive, you know, the rock and roll guys are wearing cowboy hats and buckskin fringe, and they have Indian outfits on. So they're encouraging everyone to head into this archaic revival. That's really what the counterculture was. It was you getting back to your roots, your past, you know.
So that they don't become familiarized with the advanced technology that is going to be used very soon to fucking enslave them.
So let me just... Now, I uncovered a letter. Actually, it was uncovered by Dr. David Price. And it's a letter written from Gregory Bateson to the head of the OSS in the Pacific Theater. And Bateson was working for the OSS at the time. Now, Bateson goes on to become supposedly this peace and love, philosopher promoting LSD. He probably was the one who gave LSD for the first time to Allen Ginsberg and Ken Kesey, or at least arranged for it to occur. But he's famous as being, you know, this kind of peace and love guy, right? However, in the letter, a little different Bateson comes out. In the letter, Bateson's, and I'm going to paraphrase, but I'm going to use the actual words he used. He goes, okay, so he says, you know, we've got a problem here in Indochina. After the war, we're going to need to kind of recreate the slave state. And we want the slave state to be in a little better than the first, the way it was there's a lot of rebellion. He goes, experiments. So he's actually talking about experiments. He goes, experiments have shown that the best way for a superior people to control an inferior people, and these are his words, I'm quoting, a superior people to control an inferior people is to create a native or archaic revival. He says you have to get them to display the traits of their past, their poetry, their clothing, their craft. He says, because if they do that, if they feel like their culture, the past, is the most important thing, then they're not going to be jealous of the technology the superior people need to bring about their slavery. Okay, so this was the this is the, and now Bateson goes on, and he's the one who actually creates the CIA. A little known fact: when Donovan was the head of the OSS, he went to President Truman. He goes, "Look, we need to have the OSS continue after World War II." And Truman said, "No, it's too expensive." So Bateson is the one who came in, and he said, look, the reason we need the CIA is because now with nuclear weapons, wars are going to be very, very difficult for us to fight because we could blow everything up. So we're going to need to develop psychological techniques to control people. Right. This is the beginning of the CIA. So Bateson is the one who actually created the rationale that became the CIA. It was because of that, then Truman decides, okay, you're right, I'm going to give you the funding, and the OSS became the CIA.
That guy sounds pretty psycho. It's strange that his name isn't Norman Bateson.
So Bateson then goes to Palo Alto, where MKUltra begins. He arranges for people who are going to be, you know, leading the culture off a cliff, like Allen Ginsberg, Robert Hunter, who's the, he's the lyricist for the Grateful Dead, and Ken Kesey. He's going to write, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which, you know, basically, you know, says that, you know, in an insane world, being crazy is the only way to, you know, get along. And at the end of it has the Indian break free and go back to his native land, you know. And so what the Cuckoo's Nest is just a, you know, one of the psych operations to try to get the culture prepared for this, for Bateson's archaic revival. That's really what's going on here. And so now Kesey has the acid tests. You've heard of these, I take. The acid tests are really evil. I mean, that you really don't get to see evil manifested in this way, you know, publicly very often in history. Kesey wearing a top hat because of the Masonic connections. I do a deconstruction of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, his book, and I show the Masonic imagery in it that he has. Anyway, he produces these acid tests where the public's invited in, and these are teenagers, you know, and they can take LSD. No charge, nothing, just take LSD. I actually knew, I didn't attend, but I knew people in my high school class who went to the acid test that was held in Watts in 1966 or 65, one of those years. And so this was what we were up against. The government was engaged in malfeasance, right? It was working against its population. The population had no defense. We didn't know that we were being attacked, right? And so the culture started to transform. The ethnic neighborhoods, the family, the extended family, these things just all started to disappear. And so we now have the debased pornographic culture that America possesses today, where you have the single mom, if there is any children, the father is a bartender who, you know, has 6 hours of pornography a day. I mean, these are exaggerations, but I'm just giving you a flavor of what's going on out there. And there just isn't any anything the government has to worry about, because such individuals, obviously, they're completely isolated. And so what's happened is through the archaic revival, we have been atomized. The organizational strength that the ethnic communities had has been destroyed. And
essentially,
the family
they've gone and had a look at what is the fabric that binds society together, what is it that makes it strong, and they severed all the connections from everybody with the fabric of their very society.
Exactly. And so we and I spoke before, and I was saying that, you know, you can actually trace this whole process back further. It goes quite a ways back. I refer to the Frankfurt School, which created what's called cultural Marxism, which is just basically
political correctness.
Political correctness. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what that is. And it criticizes everything about the culture. It had what's called critical theory, which is just means attacking everything. Just attack every single linchpin, every single join that creates culture is attacked. You know, the Frankfurt School was founded by Gregor Lukacs. Very interesting guy. He was in the Comintern, right? The Communist International, an intellectual. And he was employed by Béla Kun, who was the Comintern leader of Hungary following the revolution in 1919. And they gave Gregor the control over the education of the country of Hungary. That was his role. And he immediately attempted to transform the sex education. He wanted basically unrestricted sex. He thought that the structure of marriage was slavery, right? The woman was property in this kind of situation. He was a Marxist, classic Marxist guy. And so he tried to implement a very, and remember, this is 1920, very, very risque version of sexuality in the Hungarian student population. The Hungarians wouldn't buy it, and he had to get out. He went to Germany, to Frankfurt, where he founded the Frankfurt School. Now, the Frankfurt School, it took the position that the classic Marxist theory of the proletariat revolution wasn't going to occur. They had seen in the first, communist revolution, the resistance to it. But they wanted that political control that Marx talked about. And so they said, well, the way to achieve it is just to do it through culture. Instead of a military confrontation, we can obtain our goal through culture.
Well, the very concept of culture is with the word cult, right? And it turns out that MK Ultra and all of those mind control institutions and various cult leaders and things like that came about were all very well connected. So they've, again, not only have they severed connections, but they've also created all new cults in all different directions. That the cult of medicine, the cult of law, the cult of entertainment, the cult of sports, the cult of pornography, the cult of everything. And that way, not only do you have no independence and no actual, you know, cultural strength, but the only place that you can belong to is one that abuses you, brainwashes you, lies to you, and uses you.
Exactly. Well, that's the world we live in, you know. And I mean, just as another example, Aleister Crowley, you know, he creates a cult. It's a bizarre form of Freemasonry, but it appears even today among the American political elites. I don't know if you saw the WikiLeaks that were related to Pizzagate. People were looking at this, and it was sad, but the real meaning, and I think that the pedophilia that is being alluded to, I think it's correct, though I have no evidence beyond just the, it's a coherent framework to look at these weird emails with, but I have no evidence beyond that. But what was clear is that these are individuals who are members of the Aleister Crowley cult, because they talk about spirit cooking. And they're attending a spirit cooking dinner by Marina Abramovich. And the spirit cooking dinner is basically her variation of what's called the Cake of Light, which is a Crowleyan sex magic ritual where you eat really weird stuff and engage in strange behavior. When she brought out the spirit cooking dinners in the 1990s, at that point, you know, there was no issue. Everyone knew it was Crowley. But now... it's really, she's hasn't really, you know, she doesn't talk about this much, but the way you know that this group is engaged in this is in another email, they talk about a Thelema favor. They need a Thelema favor done. And the favor is spending time with Barack Obama, by the way. But anyway, so they asked for a Thelema favor. Well, Thelema is Aleister Crowley's term for his religion. And it's not a term that normal people use, and it would never be something anyone would understand the meaning of who wasn't, you know, inside this world. So when you combine the Cake of Light spirit cooking and the use and understanding of the word Thelema, believe me, the elites are into weird crap. There's no question, you see. So when you talk about cults, you know, we're dealing with, you know, some very, very basically psychopathic could be a term applied to them. I mean, this is what the ruling class is made up of, and they are a secret society.
There was, in fact, a German banker who came public very recently, did a full, like, 40-minute interview, and said that he thought he was kind of, like, getting into the club, and essentially it was talking about taking his conscience and putting it in the freezer. And that came back, and the freezer opened when they started to do child sacrifice. Yeah. And he was like, no. And then he went public, because once you're at that level, if you keep your misgivings to yourself or something like that, and you don't tell anyone, they can easily kill you in an accidental little thing. But if you come public, on the other hand, and have the public spotlight on you, all of a sudden you have this protection, because they can't just kill you. Because it'll look very suspicious, and it'll start to go out. And I think there was a CIA former assassin that I interviewed one time, and he said, at this point, I'm more valuable alive than dead, because when I die, I have a number of things that are going to be released just in case, right? That's how you keep it wrapped up. And I'm like, whoa. This is like when you're dealing with a gang. Essentially, you know, you don't like the drugs that they're selling to you. Do you go back to the gang and complain? No, they'll give you a 2x4 over the back of the head and you're dead.
Yeah. And that's what we have. I mean, the basic reality is a secret organization, and it is organized. I'm sure there are different, you know, branches of it. The Grateful Dead are very useful to study, because you can see you have the banking families, the Freemasons, CIA, Tavistock, Bohemian Grove. I mean, you've got the whole combine. And they have the different secret societies with different names, so the public doesn't, you know, catch on to the idea that they're all just one big clump of secrecy, but they are. And so that group has slithered into the media control. It has slithered into financial control and obviously political control. I've trying to make popular a term I come up with of lifetime actor, because the one of the ways they maintain control is they give us people who appear to, have a certain political perspective, but in fact are controlled by the club. And I would say like Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton would be examples of this. And, you know, people were saying, well, Trump is going to drain the swamp and you'll see all of this activity against the deep state. And I said, no, you're just it's absurd. I said, look at who did they give Nikola Tesla's intellectual estate to following Tesla's death? It was Donald Trump's uncle. And what did he do with it? Well, he said it couldn't be made public, right? You couldn't have a more, you know, redder flag than that, showing that the family is connected in. And then if you look at Trump's father and the associations that he has, it's all just, you know, deep state operatives. So Trump has always been under control. He's always been, he is a lifetime actor. The way that they developed the American political campaign is they created candidates that would manifest the greatest hatred in the group that didn't like them. You see, that's how our candidates are created, is because they know they're putting on a puppet show, obviously. And so if you are putting on a puppet show, what you need is really good drama. The bad guy is really bad. The good guy is really good. So you don't see the strings. Well, the people who didn't vote for Trump hated him with a passion. The racist white male, you know, he made the comment about grabbing pussies. This was, you know, wasn't well received by the feminists. And then Hillary Clinton, I mean, the, you know, cultural Marxist librarian from outer space. I mean, it's just these were artificial characters designed to create a fake struggle that would distract people from the fact that there's strings over both of them.
Within 3 days of Trump's election being made public, right, I was like, okay, I'll look at one article that the New Zealand Herald put out. Who are all his possible candidates for his cabinet going to be? And I go to, okay, Dr. Google, let's see what you got for us. Person's name plus the word Freemason. Ah, we got a hit. Person's name plus the word Trilateral Commission. Ah, we got a hit. Person's name plus the Council on Foreign Relations. Ah, we got a hit. And they got like Freemasons in there, Council on Foreign Relations, people from Yale's Skull and Bone Club, Goldman Sachs. And I'm looking at the Truth Movement, who taught me about recognizing these groups and all of these fuckers, telling me that to vote for Trump because he's going to drain the swamp. Oh, my God.
It was so sad. I mean, the people who voted for Trump are going to be as disappointed as the people who voted for Barack Obama. I mean, you know, the inner city, the black, kind of political class, they thought Obama was going to invest in America's inner city. I mean, what a joke, right? He invades Afghanistan.
That was actually one thing back in the day when Barack was president, when I wanted to have a good laugh, like I was feeling really angry or something like that, I would sit down and watch a Barack Obama speech. Fuck, that's some funny shit. Oh my God, I'm going to create jobs. I'm gonna stop the wars. It's killing me. Oh my God.
Yeah, it was just absurd. And so tragic, right? And if you look at Obama's mother, you see, they had the narrative about the birth certificate and the father, right? He was Obama Kenyan or not. This is just the red herring. It's Obama's mother that is the connection into the secret society. If you look at, who was the PhD advisor, Alice Dewey, who's John Dewey's, the creator of like the debased public school system in America. Her mother was a banker in a bank that has connections into the CIA. She goes to Indonesia and works with Gregory Bateson, for God's sakes. I mean, it's just a straight pipeline of secret society control, and they bred a black face to basically then bring that to the public and control it that way. You'd mentioned when you go and you check and you see Freemasons and Council of Foreign Relations. So, getting back to my little narrative of the history of all this, Gordon Wasson is really the founder of the psychedelic movement. He is the godfather. Tim Leary cites him as, this is the person who started it. All of the later puppets would point back to this guy, Wasson. Well, who's Wasson? Well, I mean, oddly, he's the vice president of J.P. Morgan Bank. That's a strange. No, but it gets worse. But he's also in the Council of Foreign Relations. But guess what role he is in the Council of Foreign Relations? He's the chairman. There. Oh. He's actually found letters of the Council of Foreign Relations minutes, and it'll have, you've got Alan Dulles, you've got just name the, Donovan. They're all sitting there, and it says Chair R. Gordon Wasson, right? This is the guy who starts the psychedelic movement, is the chairman of the Council of Foreign Relations, and which was something, very secret organization you couldn't get into. And so the public is fooled, right? They have the Grateful Dead comes in front of them. You're taking LSD. Ken Kesey is wearing his top hat, handing out LSD to children. The Grateful Dead are singing Keep on Trucking. And in back of it, you have the Council of Foreign Relations, the Freemasons, Bohemian Grove, the Mellon Banking Family, MK Ultra. I mean, these are the organizations that are represented just in the band and with Kesey and the people who are like the funding, they're all sitting there. I mean, if you actually took a picture of the Grateful Dead's and the original, that's who you'd have. You would literally have a collection of nothing but high level secret societies. And they're putting out this folk music, right? So we were let off a cliff, and now we have to try to do something about it, because, I think genocide is right around the corner. I mean, the process, it just keeps on going. Once they've atomized us so we can't really defend ourselves, now you've got, the pollutants, who knows exactly. The vaccines in California now, it's mandatory. Every public school kid has to take 67 vaccines by the time they get through the sixth grade. 67 vaccinations.
Well, they'd need that just to be dumb enough in order to continue get through grades.
I mean, when you look at autism, and I try to get people to
well, Joe, unfortunately, we've just coming to the first hour break. So we'll pick up that autism tangent when we come back, because this is the lighter side of genocide, and we like to keep it provocative. My very special guest is Joe Atwill, and ladies and gentlemen, we will be back after the break with that Vinnie Eastwood goodness that I know you have all been craving. Back in a moment.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow slaves of the plantation, welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's Vinnie with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood like go ahead, make my news. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinnie Eastwood Show. The only thing worse than the truth is Vinnie's jokes.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, one night a week for the listening discomfort of the intelligence agencies that are listening through our Skype. Now, my very special guest is Joe Atwell, and before we go back to him, just want to remind people that American Freedom Radio is, in fact, a listener-supported network. So go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on that little donate button. Give them $1 a month through Patreon, because they do a heck of a lot of work giving a platform for hosts like myself, like a good parasite does, and also they edit all of the shows. When you're listening to them live, there are little things that happen that you don't hear on the archives because special care and attention gets taken for doing them. And not many networks actually archive their shows, let alone edit them well so that you can listen to them more fluidly. We do that here at American Freedom Radio. When I say we, I mean there's only one frickin' person who does it, and he busts his ass doing it, and that's the owner of the network, Danny. So go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and give him $1 a month. Are we asking too much? I don't think so.
Yeah, I just wanted to confirm that. I mean, look, the mainstream media is a weapon. It's designed to damage your mind. American Freedom Radio is a step in the right direction. You know, it's a step in the right direction to step toward a media that we have some say in. And so we really need to support it. So $1 a month, man, that's the best money you'll ever spend.
Yeah. And as the old saying goes, there's plenty of free cheese in a mousetrap.
There is indeed. So.
Right, and also I need to raise another $200, ladies and gentlemen, in order to cover this week's rent. I've also gotten news that I'll be flying down to the New Zealand Skeptic Society meeting in November in New Zealand, and that's going to be a hell of a lot of fun. I'll be talking for an hour. I'll wonder how many seconds I'll get to speak before I get shouted at or people start walking out, but we'll see. It'll be fun because I'm not like an... I don't like to be a dick to the audience, despite my methods of convincing you otherwise. Now, there's also a lot of stuff on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, including previous interviews with Joe Atwell, among other things, all there archived on the YouTube as well. So sometimes you can listen to somebody on a radio broadcast and you go, well, I wonder if Vinnie's interviewed them. Google Vinnie Eastwood plus that person's name and... 9 times out of 10, it'll come up. Yep, they've interviewed them before. And 9 times out of 10, I've probably done the best interview where the guest has had the most fun and really got to say what's on their mind in a light and unrehearsed fashion. Welcome back, Joe Atwell, my very special guest. Well, the last thing that we were talking about was autism and particularly how it relates to the schooling system, because I was just like thinking... Who did I interview the other day? I think it was Dr. Rima Labor, and we talked about how autism is actually a created disorder, so that it's actually being, shall we say, catered at the moment to create a new Delta slave workforce, just like in the in Brave New World, who can perform simple, repetitive, menial tasks, and you can treat them any way you want, and they won't stand up for themselves.
Exactly. And remember, when you're looking at autism, you're just looking at a particular fraction of the bell curve of intelligence. And that means when you see autism explode like this, that you're having the same percentage of brilliant individuals that aren't in existence, because the whole curve is shifting in the wrong direction. So they are definitely manipulating the populations to stupidity. You know, I have a new book coming out called The Secret Language of the Oligarchs, and it focuses on Brave New World, Huxley's book, and on the Shakespearean play that the title comes from. And I try to sound the alarm to the public about Brave New World, that this isn't Huxley warning us. This is Huxley telling us what the plan is. You see, they love legacy. And so there's... you know, some very easy to understand symbolism once you kind of get the perspective that Huxley's working from, that shows you that this is a vicious Freemason empire wherein, you know, you are chemically and psychologically placed into categories, and you can't even rebel because your mind is under complete control. So when you think about autism, and notice that they have TV shows now. In America, you know, they're socializing us to get further and further into the archaic revival. They have nothing but these survivor shows on. They have, you know, dual survivor, man, woman survivor, and the most absurd one is called Naked and Afraid, where they take two individuals, a man and woman, who don't even know each other. They have no tools or clothes, and they have to go into a primitive place for 21 days and live, right? So this is the population in the post-electric world that they have in mind for us, and they're just socializing us with all of these ideas about that being primitive is a hip thing, you see. But it's that, how primitive? Well, that's all the way back to like before fire even, you know. I mean, so that's really what they have in mind. You're going to see, a one technical structure after another removed from the middle class and then from the lower classes until everyone is just shoved into this clump. And that's the last generation. They're also promoting sexualities that don't produce, right? It isn't just the single mom who cannot create a family, right? You have now all of these different genders, you know, trans, the GBTL crowd, not to be bigoted toward them. They are victims, right? But they were created artificially. This whole process to create a very popularized homosexual and now even a transsexual culture, that's a weapon. That's something that has been for the longest time one of their goals to try to break the family apart, one piece at a time.
This one time I interviewed Dr. Catherine Albrecht, and I asked her, what's the one thing about pharmaceutical drugs that you just don't tell people? Because they won't get it. And she says, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that many pharmaceutical drugs actually can turn people gay.
Yeah, that's right. They're estrogen mimickers, and they will raise estrogen in males. Just like the autism is an example of how we're shifting over. Look at the decline in sperm count in European males. It's catastrophic, 50% of what it was in the 1920s. So you have had all of these toxins put into our environment to dumb us down, desexualize us, so that the chemical assault goes on 24/7. Then you have the cultural assault because, you have like Bruce Jenner being given awards for courage for, transgender operation.
Then changes back.
She's what does she call it? Polysexual. She goes every week. It's a different concept. Well,
like gone are the days when everything was poly and a simple.
Right. Yeah, that's right. It's gone. But I mean, this isn't a structure from which a family could ever be produced. And young girls who are influenced by, her and by that whole class of people, they're just being pulled away from the capacity to have. What could produce a family, because that was really what from Bateson and even beyond before this from Huxley, the Eugenic Society, they've always had where we are now in mind, where the society would be completely atomized. The individuals are completely isolated, and now they are completely dependent upon the state. And who is the state? They are the state, you see. They have the technology, they have the weapons, and now you are at the last generation.
Now, that's the, what was it you said talking about before, the authoritarian personality of the U.S.
Yeah.
Jewish Committee.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, this was research that was basically handed to me, or I was asked the question. The question was, what is the motivation for people inside of MKUltra, the organizing groups, right? there's a video called A Conversation on LSD. And you can see that you have like a lot of very famous people, right, who are involved in MK Ultra. And so the question I was asked is, what keeps these people together? What is their principle, you know? And so I looked back from MK Ultra, and you can see that MK Ultra came out of what's called the Macy Conference, right? The Macy Conference were established after World War II. They were basically studying humans, right? And one particular conference, the Cybernetics Conference, was studying how to program human beings, right? This was the basic premise of it. How do you know what to look for and how do you actually code them? They had Norbert Wiener, who's Johann von Neumann. These are basically the fathers of what's called cybernetics, and they were also instrumental in the personal computer. I mean, this is where Stuart Brand, who was a merry prankster, he was on the bus with Ken Kesey. He's the one who develops the mouse, right? He actually creates the press conference that releases the mouse to the public, so you can interact with your computer in a little easier fashion, you know. So this is Silicon Valley's origin. It's right there inside of Ken Kesey's Merry Pranksters bus. This is where these guys are coming from. But so I was asked about, well, where does that moral authority come from? And when I looked back from the Macy Conference, I saw a group that produced something called the authoritarian personality. Now, this group was the Frankfurt School, the group I had talked about before the show. The Frankfurt School had been developed by Gregor Lukacs, the individual who he was a Jewish individual hired by Bela Kuhn, the Jewish commentator of Hungary following World War I. And the Frankfurt School then was hired, basically lock, stock, and barrel, by a group or an organization called the American Jewish Committee, right? Rabbi Weiss. They had a lot of money, and they developed psychological testing skills to determine things like, how anti-Semitic a Gentile was, if a Gentile had what was called an authoritative or authoritarian personality, if they were ethnocentric, in other words, if they had a high level of pride in their ethnicity. So these were a set of basically psychological structures that could be used to see if there was any possibility of fascism occurring. So this is what they were claiming they were looking for, right? Now, this group then ends up inside of the Macy Conference. Again, they reappear, and they then
just reappear. They emaciated.
They just went right. And then they also end up in MK Ultra. You have, individuals. One of them, very famous, Theo Adorno, right? He goes from there to the Princeton Radio Project, which produces the War of the Worlds, that psychological experiment, where they broadcast to the public the H.G. Wells aliens, So they were, this group is involved in these large-scale psychological studies. But anyway,
wasn't that one narrated by Orson Welles?
Yeah, Orson Welles narrated it. By chance, H.G. Wells wrote the story.
Is Orson Welles like the child of H.G. Wells or his
no,
brother?
No, I don't think they're actually directly related, but they have the last name. They're both Freemasons.
Oh, my God. That's, all be well, I guess. But people didn't click back then. There's a famous guy with a famous voice narrating something, and they actually think that it's real? Because it's that easy to fool people.
I don't know. They claim that people believed it was real. I'm not sure that just wasn't part of the psyops. I'm not sure what to believe of it. I don't believe much that they tell us. But they certainly put on the event. And individuals who were in the Macy Conference, in the authoritarian personality, and then on into MK Ultra. So it's all this one. Nevitt Stanford, who is writing the authoritative personality conference, the American Jewish Society, he ends up working for what's called the SRI, which is an MK Ultra cutout, which then he writes books about the value of psychedelic drugs, right? Well, anyway, so at the end of the authoritarian personality, and this is something I would hope every one of your readers would do this little exercise. You can get the authoritarian personality. It's online. Go to the conclusion of it, the very end, chapter 23, I believe. And you just read the last four paragraphs, because they summarize. They say, you know, what we need to do is that we need to unify all of the psychological sciences to create a program on a mass scale. This is their expression, a program on a mass scale. Now, this to control people, to get them to be able to think the way we want them to. Now, we will not be restrained any more than the German fascists were. The only difference is that our propaganda will use Eros and not fear and intimidation of the fascist propaganda. So if you read the end of the authoritarian personality, you are basically reading a description of the MK Ultra social program. This is a psychological operation on a mass scale where all the different human behavioral sciences are brought together. And then they use Eros. You see, think about sex, drugs, and rock and roll as opposed to German propaganda, you know, with the hard edge racism stuff. So,
well, what is Eros? What is Eros?
Because to me,
it's just lust. Something that's in a can that you can spray out of, you know?
It would be a synonym for it would be lust, pleasure principle, Eros. The word erotic, it would come from it. Okay,
oh.
So it just means pleasure. So if you read a book that was very instrumental in the counterculture was called Eros and Civilization, right? And this is written by a guy named Herbert Marcuse. He's a member of the Frankfurt School, right? We're just finding these people everywhere, and he advocates that you have basically pansexuality. I mean, just sex with anything, you know, bestiality, men, women, it's all good. And then he complains that, you know, you don't really want to even worry too much about personal hygiene because this is kind of fascistic, right? This book, Eros and Civilization, then becomes a huge bestseller and is part of the, you know, one of the planks of the counterculture, Herbert Marcuse. So he's a Frankfurt School guy. The thing which is so weird is that The Frankfurt School is the common turn, right? This is where they come from. They are organized by Gregor Lukas, who was a common turn minister. He was the head of education in Hungary during the time when it was being run by the Bolsheviks. Well, the one half of his organization is swept up by the American Jewish Committee. The other half is taken in by OSS. OSS, Herbert Marcuse ends up as an OSS person doing an analysis for our military. Now, how is this possible? How do you get, you know, from the common turn into the OSS, and yet there's a half dozen of these people that drift right into it? So you've got this very, very odd relationship that goes on inside our government in which and these anthropologists, these sociologists, these psychiatrists can kind of drift almost anywhere they want to go in order to be able to, you know, give the government what it wants as far as the technology to control the citizens.
They're hatchet men, essentially. They get taken in to cut out the competition and to implant this new idea so that all the new psychiatrists as they get brought up and all the new doctors and all the new politicians and all the new people in any one of these fields are all getting infected by this, so that only doing it in the first place is what was necessary, and it just continues on a trickle-down effect from there.
Yeah, and so that, but what you have to always be on the lookout for is a clump of behavioral scientists, because if you look at the Macy Conference, if you look at MK Ultra, if you look at the American Jewish Committee, if you look at the OSS during World War II, wherever you have these organizations of those people, you have to you can almost be certain that the government is up to malfeasance, that they're actually doing experiments, that they're doing testing of some kind, and they're trying to develop the science of control. I mean, that's what is hidden from us 24/7, is their science of control. They have been studying it for hundreds of years, and now they have got a pretty good system developing. They are using it against us all the time. If you look at the May 1957 Life magazine cover, which is the very first moment of the youth culture, the counterculture in America, on the cover, you see a description of Gordon Wasson's trip. It's in a black box. It's a jet black and has white letters, and it's inset into the cover. And it actually describes three different articles, but the way they have the words arranged, the first one is called Great Adventure. And so the black box has in white letters, you have Great Adventure. Then the next one is Strange Visions from Mushrooms in a Mexican Desert. And then the next line is supposedly describing an article, but the words are Teenage Allowances, right? Great Adventures, Teenage Allowances. So what you're looking at is what's called neuro-linguistic programming, right? This is, they are coding the mind of the person who's looking at the magazine, that this great adventure will be allowed for the teenagers, right? That they will be able to, and this is, you know, 10 years from Woodstock, 12 years. So they're long-standing, very patient. They're working away at it. If you look at Life magazine, I mean, who is publishing this story, which incidentally is completely insane. I mean, the story that Wasson tells is, I have a decoding of it in my new book, but it's just an absolute crazy. It's just a Masonic nightmare that he's talking about. But anyway, so that's what, you know, you have there is Life magazine producing this. Now, who owns it? Who controls it? It was Henry Luce. Who is Luce? Skull and Bones, right? So you don't have to go very far in any direction when you see these programs to the secret society. You see Skull and Bones, Bohemian Grove.
I just
Grove.
Love the irony that Life is owned by Skull and Bones.
Yeah. Right.
Now, you were talking about the real translations of the Indian and Mayan texts about these drugs and stuff like that, and how they actually sometimes describe them as a probably problem, particularly with teenagers and idiots.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. And so they were worried about people misusing them, and in no case were they spiritual. The so-called shaman, this poor woman, Maria Sabina, that they have in the Gordon Wasson story about his drug experience, she was a devout Christian. I mean, the idea that this would be something where you'd find, you know, God or have spiritual element is just completely, it would be a sin, you see. So, you know, the story Wasson told is fake. He's a lifetime actor. Now, Wasson,
there's a comedian, Steve Hughes, who said that when you're taking acid, watch out for your stupid friends. And if you don't know who your stupid friends are, it's you.
Oh, it's so sad. I mean, you know, I had many friends really have horrible experiences with LSD. It was everywhere. Somehow it never cost anything. You know, people had just had it. You know, the Grateful Dead concerts, there are websites that do these estimates, and they say that over 2 million tabs were given out for free. Right. So, you know, of course, where would they come up with this stuff? But anyway, and of course, no one was ever arrested. I don't think any one of those guys even spent a day in jail. You know, and then on the English side, you know, you've got the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, you know, Keith Richards, you know, he wears the skull and bones on his hand. He, his house has basically the triangle, the pyramid, and the all-seeing eye is the, as you walk into it, and the skull and bone is just everywhere. He has, you know, a recording or film company. It's called Mindless, right? Just like the Deadhead, Mindless. I mean, these are the, you know, where the Masons want to take society. This is the, you know, the longstanding goal of it. You know, the Masons, you know, they say they come out of nowhere, but obviously they were well established by Shakespeare's time. Shakespeare actually writes about them somewhat cryptically, but does describe them as helping this project that that her organization, which is a Jewish organization, is attempting. And so, you know, the trying to understand the centrifugal energy in the secret society is critical. We've got to figure out who these guys are, what's holding them together. You know, a good place to start is, it's because it's online, people can actually see this, is this a conversation about LSD. You've got Humphrey Osmond, Tim Leary, and Al Hubbard. These are all famous kind of Johnny Appleseeds of LSD. And then you've got a ton of Jewish psychiatrists, anthropologists, right? You, Sidney Cohen, Oscar Janiger, Nicholas Burkell. These are like the original MK Ultra doctors, right? Now, the conversation is fascinating because they're lying their heads off. They're talking about, you know, this one, Sidney Cohen, he asks about, well, you know, people say that we were turned on by the CIA. Do any of you believe that? Well, yeah, Sidney, you were turned on by the CIA. You were a sub-project like 54 of MKUltra. I mean, because, see, none of them thought that the pay requisitions or any documents would get out, but the pay requisitions did get out. That, thank heavens, they did. And now you can identify these doctors by their actual projects. So when you see them talking about the question about the CIA, it's obviously, you know, they're just creating a video for mind control purposes where they're trying to deflect away from the truth. Every single person in the room is involved in the operation. Humphrey Osmond is the he's a compatriot of Aldous Huxley. And there are letters, actual letters, where Huxley is directing MKUltra doctors and experiments, right? You can, the person who's organized them very well is Jean Irvin. He has a Gnostic Media website. You can actually go there and you can see the letters where Huxley is directing. He's operating as the administrator. And he's saying to Humphrey Osmond, he's saying, go to talk to Jolly West and get this experiment done. Jolly West is, you know, doing MKUltra work. And the project that Huxley is telling Osmond to demand to get done is one that is registered as being part of the MKUltra operation. So Huxley is one of the administrators of it. Humphrey Osmond is one of the guys who's working with Ewan Cameron and Dr. Ewan Cameron. He's the guy who he was doing experiments on his patients for MKUltra in Canada. People would come in, they'd be depressed. He'd say, I have a therapy for you. He would put them in a chemical coma for a month and give them electroshock. He had patients die. Now, there was a series of lawsuits. The only reason we know this for a fact is a series of lawsuits came out, and patient after patient brought evidence, and the Canadian government basically demanded that the CIA give compensation so that there is actually a record now for the public to look at about Ewan Cameron's operations. Now, Cameron, he's just a complete homicidal maniac. I mean, he's taking mothers, putting them in a chemical coma, and then giving them electroshock, right? Claiming this is a therapy. The women could not remember their own children, right? So this is not, you know, and then he presented it as therapy. Of course, this is insane. It couldn't possibly be therapy. But now, after the fact, we know it was an experiment. This he was an MKUltra doctor.
This is how you can re-educate. This is how you can mind wipe. Exactly. This is how you can create.
Just wipe it clean. And they were, he was learning how to do it. And that's why they had deaths. They had people who had personalities they couldn't understand. All of that stuff goes to the work that he was involved with. Now, here's where it gets weird, because I don't want to.
It hasn't gotten weird.
I'm afraid I don't want to take anyone to a bad place, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to, because now Ewan Cameron, unfortunately, following World War II, Ewan Cameron was given control basically over the psychological culture of the German people. And he's the one who actually basically, you know, all of the atrocities that the Germans were purportedly doing in the concentration camps. Right.
I've heard allusions Cameron, to it.
Yeah. Cameron would be the one who would be, you know, bringing that information to us. Now, this is a problem. It's an analytic problem. I'm hoping that alert listeners will help me understand this, because I'm confused, Vinny. How in the world did the person who actually did all of the brain damaging, you know, science end up as the one that also brought us this news about these Nazis doing this kind of stuff? There's something that just smells rotten to me about this whole thing. You know, all we have, the only way we can approach understanding any of this is through an, you know, analytic, you know, I mean, we don't have enough data, but it doesn't look good to me. There's something that's wrong here. Something's wrong with Cameron being the individual. I don't know what it is, but I don't believe anything anymore, Vinny. I'm what you call a skeptic. So as far as believing, you know, information from you and Cameron, I don't think so. I'm sorry, but I just don't quite, you know, I mean, he's a, you know, Scottish Freemason kind of guy, and I don't know what's in back of him, but it's something that's really, really sick. So this is, you know, our situation is critical. People walk around, you know, you see them smiling, you know, calm. They're having nice days. The countryside, there's different. But in back of all that, the technology is being organized against them. There's literally a war that's being waged on a worldwide basis against the minds and the bodies of all of the people who are not inside the club, but they don't see it. They don't understand it's going on.
Yeah. I mean, it's sometimes I wish, you know, I had like extra hands and an extra consciousness to drive while I'm yelling out the megaphone, just about people. You see this? You're stuck, aren't you? You've been robbed of your power. You can't go anywhere. You can't do anything. And you're wasting your time on a way to something that you hate just so that you can keep living for more time. Doesn't that seem that something's wrong with that? Doesn't it seem like you're in a trap? Doesn't it seem like the entirety of society is against you? All right? It's because it is, bro. It is.
Yeah, exactly right.
And what I get really pissed off with, Joe, is that people blame everyone for being brainwashed by experts. You know, you're so stupid. You can't even see the chemtrails in the sky, or whatever the hell it is. And I came to that realization a while ago that you really can't blame people for being stupid, for being uninterested in the truth. They've been created. They've been engineered to be this way. And it's like saying, getting angry at my car, which is a piece of shit, for not being able to speed up the hill at 100 miles an hour when it's on a gradient of 30 degrees or something like that, right? It just can't physically do it. It ain't got the engine for it. It just can't. And when we go up those hills and we try to go 100 miles an hour, we get really frustrated that how the car's really crappy and shitty, as opposed to just realizing that you're dealing with a very inefficient vehicle, and it's going to take some time, perhaps some modifications, until she can get up to that stage. And it ain't going to take a very short period of time. Like, I was thinking, Joe, what if we had like a 100-year plan to undo all of the fuckery that these fucks have done?
Well, let me tell you something. First, we need to support people like yourself. You'd ask for donations, and I would just underline that, please, you know, I'll just ask for Vinny because he's too polite to do it. You know, he really should have as much support as you can, and support American Freedom Radio. This is absolutely critical, because whatever the plan is that you talked about, the 100-year plan, it's only going to be accessible to people if there's information sources. So first, there's two things we have to do. We have to make this pipeline that American Freedom Radio and your show represents bigger and bigger and bigger. More and more people have to be connected to it. It has to be 24/7 everywhere, right? Because we have to become our own media. We have to start doing news. We have to do a false flag analysis of events as it occurs, right? There is the appetite for it now. The people are not used to paying for it, right? The mainstream media has the advantage of, you know, because the costs are all built into cable bills and things, that it seems like it's free. But people have to stop, and you know, no one has any money, right? We're so poor. But this is something we have to do. We've got to support the shows. We have to support the network. Now, the second thing is, and Vinny, I mean, I don't know what to say. You're just a bloody prophet. I mean, you're absolutely right. We have to develop the plan. Now, how do we do this? Well, we have to study what they've done to us. We need to know the techniques that are being used. We need to understand things like neuro-linguistic programming, lifetime actors. I'll give you one really, you know, like hopeful thing. The expression false flag is now generally understood. You see, just having a referent helps people's minds operate rationally. Just that the fact that they know that false flags exist, that they know the term, they're able now to have a little more skepticism automatically. Lifetime actor, critical expression, because you when you look at Trump or you look at Clinton, you don't want to engage emotionally with these individuals. You want to consider them in a role. You see, the expression lifetime actor, I think, is valuable. There's just a lot of vocabulary we have to develop, and we also have to develop some science. We need to actually be able to understand, you know, how, for example, like the autism, right? Exactly how they're causing this, because we need to be able to reverse it, right? I think we really have to be very, very careful about the iPhone. I mean, just think of the amount of malevolence that is available, you know, when you have a device like that, that people are physically touching and has energy in it and is in communication. I mean, I don't have any, you know, thing that I can point out, but I'm just saying this is a dangerous situation. And if you look back at the origin of it, you can see that they have been planning to have this thing in our hands for, you know, for decades. And so we should be careful about this. And then, of course, we need to develop educational systems. We need to be able to educate our children. You know, if I had children in my home again, I would be homeschooling. I would be trying to find other families that had the similar perspective so I could socialize my kids with people that are not basically in the matrix, you know, that are not just believing everything and parroting this propaganda.
It's called the Mr. Smith effect. When you say 9/11 is an inside job in an otherwise peaceful conversation, the person across from you who you've been talking with nicely suddenly turns into Mr. Smith.
Right. Yeah. I speak out all the time about 9/11. And I always say that what my little spiel is this. I go, look, Building 7, its collapse is symmetrical. It's at free fall speed. It has a pyroplastic dust cloud that comes out. It was brought down by fire, according to the people who claim that it wasn't controlled demolition. And someone predicted it was going to collapse. There's actually a video of the BBC reporter talking about the thing collapse. I said, okay, all of these things are characteristics of controlled demolition. Not a single one of them has ever occurred in a demolition or a collapse of a building that wasn't a controlled demolition. So when you have a multiplication of singular events, right, they're all like 1 in 100,000 or something, you now have your 5 standard deviations away from anything that's possible. I mean, this would be like saying, well, tomorrow morning, the moon is going to crash into the earth. I mean, that's how the idea that it's not controlled demolition. So I just say that's this very simple little thing, is that all of these things are elements of controlled demolition, and they are never, ever, not a single example of one of these things occurring in any other kind of collapse of a building. So this can only be controlled demolition. It's simply impossible. Sometimes it works, and then sometimes they hit me in the head. No, they would never hit me in the head because I'm too big. But I mean, you know, they'd want to hit me in the head if I wasn't such a giant. But so
yeah, it's because it's cowardly, right? Mm-hmm. And you have that sort of thing. And I'll just kind of like figuring now, you know, maybe that's what I've got going for me. Maybe that's why yeah. I've only been pushed around by the cops a couple of times and shoved around by people on the street once or twice at a 9/11 protest, rather than kind of like all the time.
It's a tough world out there, and it's going to get, you know, you can see it's getting steadily meaner and more controlled. I think the next phase will, you know, have a financial collapse. And I think then you're really going to see the hard edge of technical dictatorship.
Yeah.
Because people will be desperate for food and protection. Because in the United States, we've got these situations where they have inner cities that have, each one of them has over a million automatic rifles owned by the population, a million, right? When that group gets hungry, they're going to be a force to be reckoned with, won't they? Right. And so I think that what you're about to see is kind of a gladiatorial pit where notice in Europe, they're bringing in, for some reason, even though the economy is trash, they're bringing in Muslim males, right? Millions of them. Why are they doing this? What is the point? Well, I think what you're about to see is a gladiatorial pit where they're going to collapse the financial system and get comfortable in their, bug out pavilion seats and then just watch the populations tear each other to bits.
Mm. Well, one can
so I think that's our, yeah.
You know, it could be worse. Can't imagine how, but, you know, there we go.
Well, it could be worse, except, you know, that reminds me of like a joke that I saw during the campaign when the, the spirit cooking came out, you know, and some people were smart enough to recognize that the thelema, the pedophilia stuff is, you know, it's tragic. It looks to me coherent, you know, habeas corpus. We don't really have a smoking gun or a body. But it's absolutely clear that the spirit cooking and thelema stuff is going on. And this is Aleister Crowley. Well, he is the world's most famous Satanist, right? And so I saw this joke, and it's this guy going, well, you know, if Hillary gets elected, you know, yeah, she's a socialist, and yeah, you know, the transgender people. And then he's looking, and he goes, oh, and she's a Satanist. That was like, what? Oh, my God. You know, here we go. So, you know, but buckle up, Vinny. It's going to be a wild ride over the next 10 years, one way or another. Got to alert the population. Got to get, you know, whenever anyone, you know, I get this all the time. They go, well, gee, Joe, where should I go? You know, well, where do I go? Fiji? You know, I mean, New Zealand is obvious. It's like people want to go to New Zealand, you know. I got to get to New Zealand. Well, you know, I go, no, you don't want to do anything. What you want to do is stay where you are. Become the man or woman that you really should be and politically organize. That's what you should be doing. And if you are of a point where you're ready to bug out, you know, to get a bunker or move to, you know, like someplace and live out like a squirrel, I mean, you should have the courage of your convictions and you should be trying to politically organize. I tell people, look, speak up. Speak up in public meetings. Don't be intimidated. We are so intimidated, right? You can't even talk about 911. You know, I don't get asked to many parties any longer, even though you can imagine how much fun I am.
Me neither.
Because I don't let the 911 thing. I go, no, you're just wrong. Let me explain it to you again. You know, because it is controlled demolition. And you're simply in violation of the laws of physics with your position. And so it's just too irrational. I can't let you just walk out of here with that.
Did you know that you can buy a phone that you can hurt somebody with now? It's called an iPhone. Before there was a bit of a problem with a 100-year prediction. It's like, and I heard this interesting quote, that a corrupt church would rather burn their prophet than their corrupt church to the ground.
Yes.
Right? Well, and I had one of my listeners asking me.
That's you and me, I'm afraid, and you know, everyone wants to bring it forward. But it's just too bad. This is just the world we're in. These are the things we got to do. And so... if I can encourage anyone to do anything, it's to recognize when you're intimidated and then work against that. Try to speak out, try to find a way. And, you know, it's like, I'll give you just a practical example. If you set up a coffee table at a farmer's market and just say, you know, in America, I would say, you know, First Amendment, I'm here to freedom of speech and I want to talk about 911. If there's one of you, it's easy, you know, people come by and they glance at you and it's intimidating. But if a couple people, they go, you know, this makes a lot of sense, and they start showing up, if you get like two or three, the intimidation is zero, because now you actually have a kind of a community, and a community can always find a way to resist intimidation. And so that's why, you know, if you look at the political rallies and they have someone, you know, that's in opposition to Hillary Clinton would stand up, you know, and say something, they just taser the hell out of the guy and drag him away, you know, like, well, what happened to the First Amendment? But they're doing it because they have to maintain the intimidation. I mean, you're at the point now where mainstream media is seen as reliable by like less than a third of the population, right? And so there's a real opportunity now to create a different kind of political vision. And so they're worried about the intimidation, you know, not being sufficient. So you've got to be, that's why, you know, at those kinds of events, it's best to always see if you can get a group to do it, because it makes it so much harder for them to, you know, basically just, you know, taser everybody. That I have never seen them come in and like taser like five people. Five people, they would treat differently. They would basically, the candidate or whoever it is, you know, would tell them to shut up, and then they would be surrounded by a quote, you know, quiet, and then marched out. That's really what you need to do in order to make effective political protests. But what we're trying to do is to raise consciousness. So be creative, you know, find ways to do it. Find ways to get you know, Vinny's show, you know, broadcast into like a dorm room, that so that they don't listen to CNN for an hour or something.
My,
you know,
cousin called me one time and he goes, Vinny Bro. And I was like, what have you done, Mike? And he's like, well, I have my my other cousin and my auntie right in the room, and I put on an episode of the Vinny Eastwood show. And 5 minutes into it, they were hooked, bro, and I just thought I'd come out and give you a call and tell you what I'd just done. I go, oh, sure, bro. You know, and one of my listeners asked me the other day, well, who do I trust, Vinny? Who do I trust? You know, there's all these alternative media shills and mainstream media shills, and you can't trust the government, you can't trust the political parties, and so on and so forth. And I was like, well, I remember when I quit my job, I called my friend up, and I asked him, bro, I need to quit my job. What do you think? And he goes, does it feel right? Yeah, it does feel right. All right, and that's what led me on to this. So you can't really trust people, okay?
No, of course not.
But you can ask yourself very, very honestly, does this feel right?
Yeah, I mean, that's right, exactly. There are, you know, even in the alt media, there's just a ton of disso agents. They're everywhere, right? They do limited hangout. You know, I was listening to Noam Chomsky the other day. I mean, he's a lifetime actor, right? He's someone who, you know, he talks all of this peace talk, but then when he comes to 911, he goes, well, you know, there are always unexplainable elements in anything that you can look at after the fact. It's just, he goes, that's, you know, so you have to think about, well, Chomsky's not a complete moron, right? I mean, you may not think his semantical theories are particularly coherent, but, you know, he's not an idiot. So how is this possible that he would be comparing, you know, the events of the collapse, right? These different components, like a symmetrical collapse, a collapse at freeze fall speed, and these different elements, right? as just, well, it's no big deal. I mean, this would be like, you know, you find someone in the middle of a football field, right? And he's got two bullets in him. And they've come from different directions, and they both hit his head at the same time. And your conclusion is, well, someone must have been playing with guns over there, and then someone was accidentally playing, the bullet just hit him. It was just bad luck and a coincidence. Because see, it's the quality of the phenomena that gives you, you know, like, well, is this something that has to be investigated, or is this something you can just blow off as something that's weird? When you have multiplications of them, one after another, then you can see that Chomsky is just lying his head off. He is an agent that has been developed, his role. He has a character, right? All the world is a stage to this group. Everyone is an actor. Chomsky has been developed as a kind of peacenik so that people in the left would listen to him and respect it. So now he can deliver this blow. Now he can sit there and go, well, there's always little weird things after, you know, after events. This always happens. Really? This always happens, Tom. Right. A symmetrical collapse of a steel frame building. That's just no big deal. Free fall speed, right? Everything gives way at one time. Oh, no big deal. There's just weird things that happen. See, this is a great example of someone you can actually, you know, you can call out this guy as he is one of our first lifetime actors that we can then expose and bring to the public. I mean, he is like Gordon Wasson. He's like Tim Leary. He's like the Grateful Dead. He's like the whole collection of cultural influencers.
Gloria Steinem.
Yeah, she's been – Steinem is interesting because she was actually outed as a CIA agent before anyone else. Ms. Magazine came out, and she became an overnight feminist sensation. And the magazine was slightly different in its brand of feminism. The feminisms before Gloria were kind of Marxist. You know, they were like economic authority kind of for women. Gloria was more attack the family. She was, you know, promoting basically, you know, the women as a street fighter, not needing a man. You know, it's not necessary. She was promoting abortion. So this was a different brand of feminism. And the old line feminists, they were suspicious of her. They did research and they found out that she had worked for the CIA. This was at Helsinki in 1962. She had been an organizer of riots against these socialist youth festivals, right? And she had worked for this thing called, or had developed this business called the Independent Research Center Service, and that was a CIA cutout. And this was a group called the Red Stockings. They tried to bring out the information, and Steinem was able to quash it. She sued everybody. She had powerful people, you know, threatening everyone. But then this little tiny group, like the Columbia Housing Tenants Association, they brought it out in a periodical, a little like hand pamphlet. They brought out the information that the Red Stockings had discovered, and then that started the whole thing. And then Steinem had to go on the air. She had to actually make it's a YouTube video you can look at where she says, yeah, okay, I was a CIA agent, but I really didn't know I was a CIA agent. And the CIA actually turns out to be a really liberal organization. Now, mind you, this is when the MK Ultra is in full throttle. But she says, I never really did any intelligent work or anything. Well, then they found a pamphlet she wrote that has all of the dossiers and all this stuff. So she's just an agent.
Yeah.
I guess that noise means...
Yeah, that noise means
Vinny, the fastest 2 hours in media, buddy.
Yeah, I know. I get that a lot, hence the moniker. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I do want you to go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and make sure that when you see these episodes, share them out around social media and all of that kind of stuff. If you hear a great quip or a great joke or something like that, tell it to somebody else. Introduce new thoughts and things and feelings and open up your wallet. Give us a dollar a month through that Patreon. We'll see you again sometime, folks. Thank you very much.